owner, Southern California Edison, barely notified the public of its quarterly community engagement panel last Thursday, the only time when the public can question them directly, even if it is virtually. And besides continuing to put forth a formerly disgraced and dismissed nuclear executive from Edison as one of their spokespeople, the company continues to push for the dismantling of the spent fuel pools, trying to make it sound like a good thing, until a genuine expert tells you,
in the event of a canister breach, if they're damaged, the safest way to fix that, to repair it, is to put it underwater in the spent fuel pool, or to build some kind of hot cell or other type of containment device for nuclear waste, which is a multi-billion dollar project. So they want to destroy the fuel pools as swiftly as possible. And that's why this repair system that they've got that's so deeply flawed is so terribly important to them, because they can portray it as a potentially effective way of maintaining public safety.
Well, when you realize that common sense and protection of the public is so clearly not on the agenda at Southern California Edison, it's hard not to understand that if you live in Southern California, you are being strapped into that terrible seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, a second update on the manipulations of Southern California Edison regarding the shuttered San Onofre nuclear facility, now a de facto radioactive waste dump on the Pacific. The news keeps getting worse. We again talk with Charles Langley and Nina Babiars of Public Watchdogs about Edison's ongoing manipulations to rip out the spent fuel pools, our last line of defense in a nuclear accident with 73 tin can thin canisters, each holding a Chernobyl's worth of radioactive waste, and how a disgraced and dismissed former SCE nuclear executive turns out to be not so dismissed and a not so former, though he's still a disgrace. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than we'll be getting from the Republican National Convention this week. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, August 25th, 2020, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. As we record this, Hurricane Laura is bearing down on Texas and Louisiana as a Category 4 hurricane. Directly in its path are the South Texas Nuclear Power Station Units 1 and 2 in Bay City, Texas, Riverbend Nuclear Power Station in St. Francis, Louisiana, and closest to the ocean, Waterfront Nuclear Power Station in Colonna, Louisiana. The last time there was a major hurricane in this area, which was Harvey in 2017, at the South Texas plant, employees had to spend 3 full days on site without the ability to get out. NRC regulations state that any time a nuclear facility is going to be subjected to winds of 74 miles per hour or higher, it must be shut down. But shutdown didn't happen during Harvey, and it doesn't look like it's going to happen during Laura either. Hopefully, by the time you hear this, the storm will be over and we will know the results, and you will hear more about this next week on Nuclear Hot Seat. A new report from Moody's Investors Services finds that nuclear facilities face more heat risk than they are prepared to handle. That's because climate change, particularly intense heat, is advancing so rapidly that it poses physical as well as credit risks to America's aging nuclear fleet. Nuclear facilities are cooled by water, and in times of intense heat and drought, water resources can become either too warm or too scarce, forcing shutdowns. According to Paul Gunter of Beyond Nuclear, every nuke has technical specifications and a safety review for the temperature of the cooling water coming in from rivers, lakes, reservoirs, and oceans. Too hot? The operating license says you're supposed to start to power down or scram. In addition, and in light of Hurricane Laura, it's important to bring up a 2019 Bloomberg review of correspondence between the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and owners of 60 facilities regarding the self-assessments of risks from climate change to their reactors, and found that 54 of the reactors were not designed to handle the flood risks they now face. At the Diablo Canyon plant in Northern California, owned by Pacific Gas and Electric, that company recently asked the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to allow it to inspect and potentially repair one of its two units without shutting it down. PG&E contends that its request would not pose a safety risk. But nuclear engineer, consultant, and chief engineer at Fairwinds Energy Education, Arne Gunderson, said, "It's akin to having someone change your brake pads while you're still rolling down the road in your car." San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace has filed a strong objection to the license amendment request by PG&E to the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission that gave it permission to do these repairs without shutting down the plant. Mothers for Peace contends that PG&E's belated discovery of corroded pipes shows that their program for monitoring safety equipment is inadequate and negligently administered. And we will link to an interesting article from SanLuisObispo.com entitled, "My Tribe Lived on Diablo Canyon Land for Millennia. Now we have a chance to reclaim it." It's by Violet Sage Walker, who is traditional vice chairwoman of the Northern Chumash Tribe. The Chumash plan for the site would include multi-purpose public access to the property, no new development, conservation for undeveloped land, clean up, restore, and repurpose the former industrial sites, and produce clean energy options. That is so sane. It makes me want to have all nuclear sites granted to Native people to figure out what to do with them if they're willing to take on the burden. At least plans like this make sense. 8 miles from Cedar Rapids, Iowa, is the Duane Arnold Energy Center, a nuclear reactor. Duane Arnold always sounded like Roseanne's husband's younger brother. In any event, the derecho storm, the inland hurricane, on August 11, created so much damage at the site that they are not going to be restarting it, and it is going to be decommissioned. Admittedly, decommissioning was set to begin at the end of October, but the strong storms that hit the area caused extensive damage to Duane Arnold's cooling towers, and replacing those towers before the site's previously scheduled decommissioning was not feasible. Another one down. Bet you didn't know there was a nuclear site in Brooklyn, but there is. And National Park stewards have closed Dead Horse Bay last Thursday, August 20th, after discovering radioactive contamination in the Southern Brooklyn Park and former landfill. In 2019, officials detected excessive gamma radiation in 31 locations across the 178-acre dump. Now 84 acres have been closed off, with no word that they will ever be reopened. In Pennsylvania, shush! They don't want you to know the final destination of 66% of liquid waste from 30 municipal landfills that accept fracking's oil and gas waste. This waste contains high concentrations of radioactive materials, such as radium-226, that is carried by rainwater throughout the area in what's known as leachate, the landfill's liquid waste. Interesting article on this. We will link to it on our website. And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat. Nuclear Hot Seat. Nuclear Hot Seat. Nut Nuts of the Week.
The Democratic Party, during their national convention, released the party platform, which stated that when it comes to energy, they favor a, quote, technology-neutral approach that includes existing and advanced nuclear. It's the first time since 1972 that the Democratic Party has said anything positive in its platform about nuclear energy, and they shouldn't have done it. Nuclear is not carbon neutral. From uranium mining to transport to manufacture to purification to the debris that gets left over from all nuclear reactor operation to what has to be done to store is nuclear intense. The darn things don't even run on the energy that they produce. They've got to import it from the grid. And where is that grid energy coming from? It's not coming from nuclear sources. And unfortunately, in this country, we don't bother to look at what a combination of solar and wind and geothermal and hydroelectric and all the other genuinely renewable sources can do to generate that electricity. So it's using carbon-based electricity in order to run the nuclear reactor.
This is short-sighted, numb-nuts,
the result of lobbying and false information and who knows how much money under the table to the Democrats that suddenly, ta-da! Now we're supposed to be in favor of nuclear. Well, I gotta tell you, when it comes to numb-nutsery, this is top of the line. And that's why Democratic Party and the asshats behind this particular plank in your let's fall through the floorboards into the abyss platform, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Numbnuts of the Week.
Internationally, alarming events may not be what they initially seem, and those events we tend to overlook might be more serious than they are. In an example of the first, when that enormous explosion created a mushroom cloud over Beirut on August 4th, some people immediately jumped to the wrong conclusion, spreading rumors on social media that a nuclear bomb had gone off. It hadn't. Weapons experts knew from the start that the powerful explosion was not nuclear because it did not produce a blinding flash of light, a blast of heat intense enough to set the city on fire. And in the hours that followed the explosion, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty Organization, which operates a network of monitoring stations around the world, did not detect a telltale spike in atmospheric radiation. However, on June 22nd and 23rd, a radiation monitoring station in Sweden detected elevated levels of ruthenium-103, cesium-134, and cesium-137. Isotopes associated with nuclear fission, at levels higher than usual. Two Russian nuclear reactors are located within the suspected region as sources. Russia has refused to accept any responsibility for this radiation leak, and to date, we have no confirmed source for it, just very strong suspicions. And speaking of possible parallels with Beirut, a routine inspection of Europe's biggest and most dangerous nuclear plant at Sellafield in the UK, uncovered unstable stored chemicals with the potential to explode in the same way as the chemical stash at the port of Beirut did, with catastrophic consequences earlier this month. Sellafield is the home for the biggest single stockpile of explosive plutonium on the planet, some 140,000 kilograms of material. And in case the awareness has escaped you, plutonium is named after Pluto, the god of hell in Greek mythology. To give an indication of the potential damage of this plutonium, the atomic bomb that immolated the Japanese city of Nagasaki in an instant 75 years ago this month killed 70,000 people, and it contained just 6.4 kilograms of plutonium. Meaning that the amount stockpiled at Sellafield could create the equivalent of 21,875 Nagasaki bombs. Sellafield contains huge quantities of highly radioactive and chemically toxic liquid nuclear waste stored in decrepit tanks, all urgently requiring renovation and modernization. There is now a call for Sellafield Limited, the plant operator on behalf of the government-owned Nuclear Decommissioning Authority, to come clean on when the potentially explosive material was discovered, in what quantities, what potential explosive capacities the chemicals contained, explain why it was stored where it was, how close it was stored to nuclear materials, how sure they are that there is no other overlooked explosive cache in the site, and reveal whether any such incident has happened before at Sellafield. In another nukes and climate change story, a low flow rate on the Rhone River will likely restrict output at EDF St. Albans nuclear plant in southeastern France. EDF's use of water is regulated by law to protect plant and animal life. It is obligated to reduce output during hot weather, when water temperatures rise, or when river levels and the flow rate are low. Last month was the driest July in at least 60 years, and the first half of August was the second hottest on record, making it the 15th consecutive month with higher than average temperatures. French grid operator RTE published a similar warning for the Suze reactors in northern France last Tuesday. Out of the UK comes one of the answers to the question, how long will it take after a nuclear facility is decommissioned for it to be able to be put to other use? That's because the Dounreay site, which is the Scottish nuclear power facility, is now estimated to be available for other uses in 313 years' time. Dounreay was the UK site for the development of fast reactor research from 1955 to 1994, and it's in the process of being closed down, demolished, and cleaned up. But I think that cleaned up should be in quotes, because the Nuclear Decommissioning Authority said it would be 2333 before the 148-acre site is safe for reuse. Can't wait. Buy your building lots now. And in the Canadian province of Saskatchewan, nuclear industry players have announced their support for the launch of a research center to work on small modular reactors for use in Saskatchewan. I think that Marius and Candace Paul will have something to say about that, and we will talk to them in the near future. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment. But first, yeah, I know, there are so many issues begging for our attention and involvement these days. COVID-19, the U.S. presidential election, global warming-influenced wildfires, ice melt and extreme weather events, international warmongering, and I'm sure you've got your own personal list of issues that are making demands for your attention, pulling at your heart and soul. I know it's hard to know where to put your attention, and nuclear is rarely at the top of the list. Yet, even if we defeat COVID, improve the financial well-being and health of the populace, even if we turn around global warming and come to some political sanity, the problems of the nuclear fuel cycle and the radioactivity it releases will remain, as you'll learn more about during today's featured interview. That is why you need Nuclear Hot Seat. We don't get distracted. We look at the nuclear aspect of our world every week, in depth. Nuclear Hot Seat is the only podcast you can count on to report the ongoing, evolving nuclear truth that the industry would rather we not hear about, let alone understand. But financially, as COVID has hit you hard, it has hit us really hard, which makes your help to keep the show going more important than ever. That's why the time would be right now to support us with a donation. It doesn't have to be much. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the big red donate button where you can help us with a donation of any size. And that same red button is now where you can set up a monthly $5, the same as a cup of coffee and a nice tip here in the U.S. we should ever be able to go outside and eat again. Please do what you can now. And know that however much you can help, I am deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now here's this week's featured interview. On last week's show, Nuclear Hot Seat number 478, we learned the basics about how Southern California Edison used stealth to gain permission to dismantle the spent fuel pools at San Onofre. But after we recorded last week's show, we learned that Southern California Edison was again manipulating San Onofre information by only barely getting out notification of their quarterly community engagement panel. which is just a sop thrown to the public to create the illusion that they are listening to our complaints and taking them into consideration for future action. But still, it's better than nothing. With barely 48 hours notice, they held the Zoominar, this time promoting a dismissed and disgraced nuclear executive as their expert, quote-unquote, consultant. To learn more about this blatant manipulation, Nuclear Hot Seat again turned to Charles Langley, executive director, and Nina Babiarz, board member of Public Watchdogs, and talked to them about this latest Edison manipulation regarding San Onofre. We talked on Sunday, August 23rd, 2020. Note that in a few instances, they refer to the San Onofre Nuclear Generating Station by its industry-created acronym, SONGS. But when they do, they're most definitely not referring to music. Charles Langley and Nina Babiarz, great to have you back for this follow-up on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Glad to be here.
Thanks, Levy.
After our interview last week, you discovered that Edison had scheduled one of its quarterly community engagement panels to discuss San Onofre. They had set it for Thursday, August 19. What is the usual course of matters when it comes to these community engagement panels, and what was perhaps a little bit different about this one?
Well, usually they try and really engage the community and get some decent public attendance, but they wanted to fly this one under the radar because they held it at the same night as the Democratic National Convention. So they had very, very low attendance. There were only 79 attendees, and I'm going to guess most of those were Edison employees.
What is usually covered at community engagement panels, and why are they referred to colloquially as community enragement panels?
Well, now that they've shifted to a video format, in a sense, they're even more enraging because it gives Edison a real ability to control the venue because they're Zoom meetings and they can turn off a microphone and they have a lot more control. So you don't see the kind of stuff that you might have seen at a public meeting where a whistleblower might step up and talk about how the cans might drop 20 feet and Edison isn't reporting it. Or a fellow like Jeff Steinmetz, who I think you've seen his video, it's very powerful, talking about how Edison lied about that very same event. So that's kind of taken away from the public. You don't see demonstrations, for example, where in one case, 80 or 90 people actually got up and dropped lemons right in front of the NRC officials at the meeting as a form of protest. That's not going to happen with a virtual meeting. So it does inhibit dialogue to some degree.
You mentioned Jeff Steinmetz, and he's one of the people who's been very involved as a community member speaking about this. He was speaking at a community engagement panel meeting last year, March 28, 2019. We have audio from that. Is there anything you want to do to set it up so that we understand what it is that we're listening to and where in the chronology of what's happening at San Onofre this took place?
Well, one of the questions that Charles posed on Thursday night was in relation to the dismissal of the chief nuclear officer, Tom Palmisano.
Edison had fired Tom Palmisano after there was a huge public uproar about the fact that Tom Palmisano was still the chief nuclear officer after he'd been caught lying repeatedly to members of the community at the community engagement panel. And you see some very good videos on that page if you want to take a look at it.
Actually, we have the audio from that, which I think reads almost as well as the video. We'll also have the video up on Nuclear Hot Seat. But this is from March 28th, 2019, community member Jeff Steinmetz speaking at the Edison community engagement panel. At one point, he plays a small tape recorder with the audio on it from Tom Palmisano lying at a previous community engagement panel.
My name is Jeff Steinmetz. I'm a concerned citizen from San Clemente, California. I just want to be able to live in San Clemente and raise my family in San Clemente and continue to work in San Clemente. I honestly don't think that's really something that we'll be able to do. And I think it's because Southern California and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission regularly lies to us. On August 9th, Tom Palmisano came up here and lied to every one of us in the audience, but also lied to every one of you on the panel. Each and every one of you was lied to if you were here on August 9th. And you've had two sessions of the CEP meeting, and none of you has asked one question about it. None of you have questioned whether anything he actually says is viable. That's not right. 73. Do you remember seeing this?
We've made good progress. We do periodically stop. We stop during the week of Memorial Day to rest the crews. We stop for crew rest to do maintenance on our equipment. And we're in one of those stops at this point when we completed number 29 last week. I expect we'll restart loading in a week or two during this time.
That's Tom Palmisano up here deliberately lying to you, trying to convince you that there was a different reason for why they actually stopped work. We all know basically what came up at 2:20 in the same presentation, which is on video. David Fritsch stood up and said the real reason as to why it was happening. Why isn't the CEP panel, the panel that says that it is supposed to protect the communities, doing anything or saying anything to Southern California Edison? That's ridiculous. Now, as far as the blind lift analysis, it's fine. It's good that Tom finally admitted that it is a blind lift. I'm glad you said that, Tom. A little bit surprised, especially since the August 9th meeting. But the only neat reason why you need a hokey rope system, if you don't have it, is because you don't have a precision downloading system. And you have no way of knowing if a canister is being gouged or not. The entire industry is now aware that Holtec doesn't have a precision downloading system. And worse than the public even knowing, now their competitors know. And Southern California Edison is pretty much the laughingstock of the industry because they selected this lemon. I mean, if you go, I'm a salesperson, I go to my competition, if I know I have a major defect in my product like that, I move on to another job. You can't sell crap like that when your customer, when your competition has got the goods on you like that. But here it is, Southern California Edison, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and Holtec still trying to sell us that this system's good. It's not.
That was community member Jeff Steinmetz speaking at the Community Engagement Panel on March 28, 2019. Also speaking at that same Community Engagement Panel was San Diego-based trial attorney Mike Aguirre.
In law, when a witness lies in a material part of his testimony, the jury is told that they can disregard his testimony as a whole. And Tom, on August the 9th, you lied twice. You told the audience that the downloading had stopped to give a crew a rest, if the crew a rest. And then when the whistleblower came forward, you lied again. You said the reason that you hadn't reported it that night was it wasn't that big of a deal, but you had already made the agreement with the NRC that it was a big deal and that SCE wasn't going to do any more downloading. You really need to go, Tom. You really need to go.
Attorney Mike Aguirre, this is just some of what took place at that meeting a year and a half ago. Now, what was the situation regarding Tom Palmisano, and what currently is the situation with Tom Palmisano?
They fired Tom Palmisano quite publicly. It was in all the newspapers, which sort of called off the hounds for his dismissal. And then they quietly hired him back a few months later. And then they brought him to the fore in public meetings as a consultant. And in this capacity as a consultant, he kind of straddles the fence between speaking for Edison but being someone who isn't really an employer spokesman for Edison. So they're playing a very tricky kind of legal game here.
And I want to give a specific example of what Charles is describing that occurred last October 17th, 2019. It was a critical meeting because that was the meeting where Edison needed their permit for the demolition of all the buildings to be taken down by the California Coastal Commission. And of course, one of the things that it was in question are the cans that have been scratched, gouged, damaged. And there was Tom Palmisano, not identifying himself as a consultant for Edison, to the California Coastal Commissioners and the several hundred people that were in the audience. No, he got up there and acted like he always did. He acted like the chief nuclear officer for Southern California Edison, proceeded to pitch his sales pitch on this spray nickel metal fix and allowed people to interpret that he was still the chief nuclear officer when he was a consultant. And so the reason Charles posed the question this last Thursday night is to get the truth out on the table.
You mentioned this paint-based solution. It's a nickel-based paint treatment. What is Edison or what is the Coastal Commission saying that this can accomplish? And how fact-based is that as far as you can tell?
They're claiming that they can repair a very deep gouge or dent with what they call a supersonic spray application of nickel from a little tiny little robot that crawls down the side of the canisters and sprays it on. And it's sort of like a spray-on welding. It's not really paint, but it operates like a can of spray paint going down there.
And one of the reasons this issue is so critical is that any scratch, any gouge, any damage done to those cans can initiate what the biggest problem that we all fear, and that's stress corrosion cracking. And so if that can't be repaired properly, we got a bigger problem.
Has this nickel paint-based solution been tested or modeled by anyone in the nuclear industry, or has it been certified by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission?
Never. It's not approved. It hasn't been approved by ASME, the American Society of Mechanical Engineers. It's in the process of being studied. It's been used in other industries for different applications for about 7 years. It's a completely new and untested technology.
And to answer your question, no, it has not been approved by the NRC.
So they're trying to make it seem that they have an easy fix if there's a problem, when indeed nobody knows whether this is a fix, be it easy or difficult or completely incompetent.
Yeah, and the problem is if they get a crack in a canister and then they need to remove it 5, 10, 20, 40 years from now, it's like trying to remove a cracked egg from, you know, an egg carton. What's going to happen if you put a winch on it and pull it up? It's trouble.
I want to go back to the focus of this meeting Thursday night, and that was a major item on the agenda of Edison's inspection and maintenance plan that was approved at the California Coastal Commission July 16th, and then, of course, updated Thursday night. And the reason I want to bring that up is a follow-on to what Charles was just saying, that here we've got a situation in that inspection and maintenance plan, and one of the reasons Public Watchdogs thinks that it's such a flawed inspection plan is that they're not going to be required to inspect these cans for 20 years. So if you have a process like Charles is describing with stress corrosion cracking that gets a toehold in that, in those cans, in those 73 cans with the salt in the sea air, the whole environment is 108 feet from the Pacific Ocean, then, yeah, what do we have in 20 years? Do we have a situation where that stress corrosion cracking has already taken place for 20 years? Are we going to find out that the thing's been leaking?
You're saying that there will be no on-site eyeball on canister or with any kind of camera or mechanism checking of the canisters for 20 years?
Right. And when they do, they'll only check a couple of them. There's 8 canisters that they've inspected already, and they consider that an inspection. It's a very minimalist inspection.
And this is a multi-level approval, because this is what the California Coastal Commission wrote into special condition number 19 with an addendum tacked on that wasn't even available for public to review back October 17th, 2019, Libby. And so, you know, the Coastal Commission is part and parcel of exactly what we're talking about. That inspection and maintenance plan was due to be completed by Edison by March 31st. But do you think that the public had an opportunity to review that between March 31st and July 16th? No. There we were at the July 16th meeting hearing about what the Coastal Commission was going to approve in this inspection and maintenance plan, which again is flawed. So at least Edison is consistent with being flawed design, a radioactive leak, a near miss drop, broken shims, and now we've got a flawed inspection and maintenance plan we're going to be living with for decades.
At these meetings, when someone gets up and speaks, as we heard Jeff Steinmetz do a short time ago, or Mike Aguirre after him, do they take the time to respond and answer any questions that may have been raised? Or do they just go, thank you, who's next? And they get everybody in the pipeline and everybody speaks, but nobody is responded to and no answers are given.
When they had the public meetings, typically they would avoid answering until the next community engagement panel. In the new video format, there's an inclination for them to attempt to answer kind of on the air, so to speak, but they still have a tremendous amount of control, and it's troubling. It's very troubling.
During public comment, they do go one speaker after the next, and at the end of the meeting, then they do answer questions. They often sometimes combine questions where they're like topics, that type of thing. But they do answer some questions at the end.
They edit them. They restate the questions. They'll combine questions and kind of, you know, smooth them over so that they can craft a more palatable answer.
Right.
It's still a very corporate controlled PR machine at work.
One of the listeners of Nuclear Hot Seat, who's been very involved but was not able to be on that particular call, sent me questions that she had emailed in advance to Edison. And I'd like to know if this one has been dealt with at all. She wrote, not one member of the community engagement panel is a reputable healthcare specialist able to answer questions regarding these releases, meaning the radioactive releases from San Onofre, or any other effects that cumulative radiation exposure has on women, children, and unborn fetuses. Any environmental scientist knows that radiation exposure is cumulative, so holding these engagement meetings without such an expert lends itself to continued normalization of these effluent releases as being harmless. Was that addressed in any way at all?
They addressed it by talking about how harmless the releases were because they're diluted well below background radiation levels. But the reality is the National Academy of Sciences released, I think it's the Bear 4 or Bear 5 study, which said any exposure to ionizing radiation is potentially dangerous and that the acceptable limit for human beings is zero. So, unfortunately, no one was able to bring that up in this highly controlled venue.
One of the questions, follow-on questions I did ask at that juncture in the meeting that Charles is describing is exactly what agency gave Edison the permit to quote-unquote dilute and discharge. And I figured I pretty much know who that is, but I wanted them to answer that. They did. And so that is the San Diego Regional Water Quality Control Board. And just so that you know, that San Diego Regional Water Quality Control Board is a state agency. And the reason that I'm pointing that out is how many times we've heard that the state agencies don't have jurisdiction over radiological or anything radioactive, but they do. They did. That's the agency that was accountable, and I wanted that on the record, and I wanted people to know that that is a state agency.
There's also an embedded flaw in that discussion, and that is the use of the word dilute, because to dilute something means to make it weaker, weaker, weaker until it really has no impact. But as Dr. Helen Caldicott lectured us, and I've learned from her directly, the smallest unit of exposure to radiation from anything radioactive is one atom. It cannot be diluted. What it can be, however, is dispersed. So instead of it becoming weaker, it simply becomes smaller quantities of atoms with greater spaces between them. But each one is just as potent as it was to begin with. So it's not that it's weaker. It's just that it's out over a greater distance, or it's dispersed with more water.
And that is a perfect entree to the next item that was on the community engagement panel agenda, because one of the next items was a report out on the Wheeler North Artificial Reef Project. And of course, one of the reasons that there has been double digit millions of dollars and years to build an artificial reef, Libby, is exactly what you just said. It's because the natural reef that was there was destroyed by the heat of the dilute and discharge of the radioactive water over a number of years, and they had to rebuild an artificial reef. I was at one of the report outs on that project, I think it was 3 or 4 years ago, and what was the report out? That they could not achieve their goal of getting the 28 tons of fish to repopulate that artificial reef. And what did they do next but give them phase two of another double-digit millions of dollars to continue that project? And so there wouldn't even be the need of an artificial reef, nor there would be a need for phase two if the fish were able to populate the artificial reef. So, yeah, that was the next report out on the agenda Thursday night.
The big question, of course, which you raised so well in last week's interview, is that Southern California Edison has, by stealth, gotten permission to dismantle the spent fuel pools. And the question that this particular individual who wrote to me said was that she asked, explain in layman's terms why SCE, Southern California Edison, refuses to retain the spent fuel pools at San Onofre. That's boiling it all the way down. Did they address this? And if so, what did they say?
I think the thing is that once they get rid of the spent fuel pools, this is just speculation on my part, Libby, once they get rid of the spent fuel pools, then the toothpaste is really in the tube and there's no way of getting it back out. The spent fuel pools, in the event of a canister breach, if they're damaged, the safest way to fix that, to repair it, is to put it underwater in the spent fuel pool or to build some kind of hot cell or other type of containment device for nuclear waste, which is a multi-billion-dollar project. So they want to destroy the fuel pools as swiftly as possible. And that's why this repair system that they've got that's so deeply flawed is so terribly important to them, because they can portray it as a potentially effective way of maintaining public safety.
What's in it for them to put us in a place that common sense tells us is high risk for eventual radiological contamination, not just of the site, but truly this entire area in Southern California? Within 50 miles of the site, there are 8 million people, plus the ports of San Diego, Long Beach, Los Angeles, and agricultural land as well.
Having worked in corporations before, most corporations define their goals by quarterly profits. And so they're looking for what's going to happen in the next 90 days. Have they met their objectives, their goals? And are they going to get their bonuses? And one of the things we've learned from the history of this particular project is that the vendors in particular are driven by management by objective style time deadlines. They don't get paid if they don't hit their deadlines. And that's what it's all about. You know, there's money on the table. Get this done by this date and you'll get your bonus. And I think that's what's driving the urgency to this.
Do any of them live in this area where they would be affected if anything went wrong?
Well, a lot of the workers on the IFSC and the companies that work on the IFSC You know, they're like a mobile work crew that go around doing this with nuclear reactors all over the country and toxic waste sites all over the country. The people from Edison obviously work in and around the community and within the 50-mile plume zone if there was ever a real major disaster there. So, yes, and I think a lot of them truly believe this system is safe, or they think it's safe for now. It's certainly safe for the next 90 days when they get their bonus.
One of the critical issues that, you know, we're confronting as a world, a country, Southern California, sea level rise. And so the question I posed on Thursday night was this. A report issued by the California State Legislative Analyst's Office this last Monday warns of impending hazards propagated by sea level rise, exacerbated by severe storms, king tides, El Nino events that will threaten two-thirds of California's coastline, describing areas that would include San Onofre. The report also addresses how imperative it is for local and state lawmakers to begin to plan now, most particularly to secure the funds in order to deal with the predicted consequences of sea level rise. It even prompted the California Coastal Commission Executive Director Jack Ainsworth to claim, and I quote, "The key to meeting these deadlines is funding." Ainsworth added, "There's going to be competition for that money across the United States. This is just the tip of the iceberg up and down the state with regard to the rail lines. It is a huge, huge problem," unquote. But considering that Songs actually sits, and this nuclear waste dump actually sits between the ocean and the rail line, what are Edison's plans to secure funds to move the nuclear waste site before their scheduled date of 2035, if and when it may become necessary? Has Edison secured funds through the California Coastal Commission in anticipation of what is no longer a quote-unquote worst-case scenario, but a predicted one?
And what, if anything, was their response?
Their only response was that they hadn't secured any funding from the California Coastal Commission.
But, it's always the money. They always focus on the money.
Right. But we're going to be dogging this one, Libby, because, you know, if they decide to move that ISFACI, I can't imagine that with the executive director of the Coastal Commission touting how important this funding is going to be, that there isn't going to be some involvement between Edison and the Coastal Commission to help make that happen.
And just to be clear, when you say it sounds like ISMACY, like Christmassy, only ISMACY, what you're referring to are the storage canister systems. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's the entire beachfront nuclear waste dump, which they like to refer to as an independent spent fuel storage installation, or ISFACI, I-F-S-I. And it's just part of this confusing babble of lingo that they use to, you know, it's Orwellian language to describe something truly horrible.
And again, you know, it's Edison and the NRC and all the nuclear players here that, you know, let's speak in acronyms that nobody can understand, because after all, isn't that, you know, just another way that we can hide behind the acronym curtain? I mean, if nobody can understand what it is they're talking about, how can the public actually be aware?
And also, it's a great way to discount what members of the public are saying or trying to understand, because they don't use the technobabble, and it makes them sound less official.
And it's one of the reasons why we call it what it is, and that is a nuclear waste dump.
So having gone through this, it sounds like extremely frustrating meeting, bringing up these issues. Has anything changed? Are there any promises? Are there any indications that progress has been made towards restoring a bit of sanity towards the safety of San Onofre?
No, absolutely not. The only way they're going to change is at legal gunpoint, and that's why we're suing them.
and remind people about the lawsuit that you have and what you are claiming, what you are asking in it.
Well, we actually have two federal lawsuits, both that are currently in front of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal, which is the highest level you can go on the West Coast. And we had, as we talked about last week, June 3rd, oral arguments on our federal lawsuit against public watchdogs versus the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the NRC. And they're still deliberating. We don't have a decision. But we have another court appearance coming up September the 1st, which is, of course, right around the corner next week. And that is before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal, our federal lawsuit, Public Watchdogs versus Southern California Edison, San Diego Gas and Electric, Holtec International, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And so we're hoping that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal is going to give some kind of a decision that is in alignment with what this actually represents, and that is a threat of national consequence, because this whole fight with regard to San Onofre is about a bigger picture, and that's that we've got many of these all over the country, and they're just watching what kind of precedent that Edison gets away with. I mean, if they get away with putting what we're talking about in the middle of millions of people, think about the agriculture in Southern California that feeds the world. Think about the real estate, the tourism, the pristine beaches, or as I like to remind Mr. Tom Palmisano a couple of years ago, the magnificent Pacific Ocean wasn't created to hide their design flaws. I think that it's important for your listeners to be more informed, just simply because, you know, what we're doing is holding this company and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and Holtec, a manufacturer of the cheap cans, accountable. And I think that the more your listeners are informed when given the opportunity, first of all, anybody should be talking about this to everybody that they know. It's the word of mouth that is going to really help to populate the education of this issue. And I just want to indicate, as frustrating as it is sometimes, we are holding these agencies accountable and these companies accountable, and it is forcing them to toe the line in some regard with regard to accountability. And if we can increase that exponentially, well, that would just be a wonderful thing.
We will stay in touch with public watchdogs. We will find out what is going on in the ongoing saga of San Onofre. And thanks for the work that you're doing. Thanks for holding their feet to the fire or having them at that proverbial legal gunpoint. And I want to thank you for again being my guest this week, Nina Babiarz and Charles Langley of Public Watchdogs on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thanks, Libby.
Thanks, Libby.
Charles Langley, Executive Director, and Nina Babiarz, a board member of Public Watchdogs. The website is publicwatchdogs.org. As for the questions I cited from a listener, they came from the esteemed Kathy Iwane, who left Japan after Fukushima only to land in proximity to San Onofre, where she has been a tireless activist ever since. I hadn't gotten permission to mention her name by the time we recorded, but I have it now. And I always like to give credit where it's due.
Activists, activists, shout out, shout out, shout out.
There's a new TV documentary out on San Onofre on PBS stations. It's scheduled for KPBS in San Diego this Sunday, August 30th, and may be playing in other places around the country. So check your listings and see if you can find it. The International Uranium Film Festival has not been stopped by COVID. It's going digital, and it will be on from October 15 to 18. We're going to have a program coming up about that to give you all the details. But right now, you just might want to make a mark on your calendar. And NEIS, the Nuclear Energy Information Service, invites you to join their second installment of their online program, Night with the Experts.
This time on Thursday, August 27 at 7 p.m. Central, it will be Nuclear Power as an Environmental Justice Issue, featuring Leona Morgan, who is the director of the Dine No Nukes Nuclear Issue Study Group in Albuquerque, New Mexico. The format will have Leona sharing for 10 minutes to give you some background in what the issues are, and then it's open for conversation, questions, direct involvement by anybody who gets on the call. Post your questions in the Zoom chat box, and they'll proceed from there. You can find the link at NEIS, Nuclear Energy Information Service, .org. And if you scroll down and click on the picture of Leona Morgan in a blue box right down at the bottom, it will take you to the place where you can find the Zoom link. We'll also link to it on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 479. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, August 25th, 2020. Material from this week's show has been researched and compiled from nuclear-news.net, deunrenard.wordpress.com, Beyond Nuclear International, the International Campaign for the Abolition of Nuclear Weapons, or ICANN, bloombergquint.com, newyorktimes.com, mothersforpeace.org, sanluisobispo.com, Iowa's News Now, brooklynpaper.com, publicherald.org, neis.org, Reuters.com, BBC.com, Independent.co.uk, DailyPost.co.uk, NationalObserver.com, TheBulletin.org, UraniumFilmFest.org, DrDavidLowry.blogspot.com, Forbes.com, and the ever-co-opted Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Thanks to Bruce Brinkman for his technical assistance with audio. A big shout out to all of you Nuclear Hot Seat listeners in 123 countries and counting, and those of you who catch us on broadcast through the Pacifica AudioPort Network. If you want to make certain that you never miss another episode of Nuclear Hot Seat, go to our website, nuclearhotseat.com, scroll down to the yellow opt-in box, and all you need to do is put in your first name, your email address, and we will send you a link to the show, along with some information about what's inside of it, through your email once a week. We don't bug you beyond that. You just get the one. We're always looking for community broadcast stations that want to pick up the show and run with it. And if you know of one, please let us know. Send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Let us know the station, your connection to it, and we will do the rest. More chance for audience participation. If you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Please don't message me through Facebook. I lose those. Send it to the email. I'll have it. And if you appreciate weekly verifiable news updates on nuclear issues from around the world, take a moment to go to nuclearhotseat.com, look for that big red button, and just follow the prompts once you go there. It all helps. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2020, Libby Halevi and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use is allowed, as long as you give proper attribution. You know, it's the least you can do. This is Libby Halevi of Hardestry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that luck is a terrible safety plan when it comes to anything nuclear. There you go. You have just had your nuclear wake-up call. So please do not go back to sleep, because truly we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Question everything. Intelligent radio for intelligent people. UCY.TV.